The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly
prohibited. Let's regather. No, people are quiet. It's happening. Welcome back from lunch, where we're going to really pick up, I think, from what's been going on for the rest of the conference, actually. Well, this panel explicitly addresses the political and how for this subject of female fan culture and IP, we think about what we mean by the political. We've seen the issues of the political embedded from the beginning of this conference. We saw it last night in both presentations, political implicitly and explicitly. We certainly saw it in Rebecca's keynote address and how she framed certain political issues that have motivated her and the work in this area. We saw it in the first panel where the explicit topic was what is the text? That was a deeply political question all by itself in lots of ways. And we saw it continuing in the discussion after the first panel. So this panel where we're talking about this process of thinking about what is political about this thing called female fan culture, where we can address it more explicitly. And the questions that both I think this panel and the other work we've seen so far raised is to think at some of the ways to frame it, or to think about different sites or activities that we think of as in understanding the political, and how the work of female fan culture raises questions about how we conceptualize that our understanding of the political. So some that I've identified so far and some that I am anticipating is the very process of creating works. To what extent is that process something political for whatever purposes political? The content of those works. We began with the notion that each of those works is an implicit or an explicit argument to achieve something. And that is perhaps another way of thinking about the political. Another has to do with actually the first two, which is participation in communities. To what extent is that belonging to or participating in or contributing to or drawing from communities part of what we think of as political? Then there is the activity of sharing, which is not separate from communities, but sharing dissemination of those works that are created beyond those communities. How does that raise questions that are in important ways political? Then we've seen interpretation of those works, how important understanding and interpreting those works are to internally and externally is to how those works are understood within and operate within the political landscape. In this panel, we'll see the role of the creation of journals and academia and what legitimacy means. To what extent is that a political activity, both in terms of its practices and its content? And we see a theme of practice and content being very united with each other, and perhaps not, I separate them as two different categories, but maybe they're so intertwined that one really can't. Then we see questions of law explicitly as sort of energizing political questions. or identifying or naming them or marking them in some way. And so in what are the different sites in which female fan culture interacts with law? We can think about interactions with lawyers. We can think about the development or creation of scholarly arguments, as some people in this room are doing. Is it a political act in the confrontation with corporate entities and challenging them over occupying certain territories or practices or understandings? Public advocacy about law, we will see things, we will hear about things in this panel. And even perhaps what most people learn about in law school is just mental court battles. It sort of has gotten off to the side, but to what extent is that political? And then we've seen interaction of the way these issues get framed in legal terms with social norms, and how does the creation of other social norms interact with legal definitions of things? And how do political questions help us to understand what's different about that, what's the same, what's the intersection, what are the conflicts, how do we think about those two things as operating at the same time? Pedagogical or educational practices, we'll hear about that here, but implicitly, we've heard a lot about how do people understand these questions? How do people think about copyright law? We saw that in the last panel. So both in the classroom and outside the classroom, what is the role of educational activity? Organizations. What we think of traditionally is doing politics. I mean, how does that relate to the communities and to the activities? And so what are the organizing activities? And then how does the issues of all of these as related to female fan culture relate to other kinds of movements or communities who are engaged in overlapping questions about what are the political dimensions, what does that mean in this context? And so we can identify issues, we can identify tensions or conflicts, and perhaps even we'll get to questions of priorities or strategies and how these things all fit together and why they matter in what people here at this conference think that this that it's important to achieve in terms of the activities of and maintenance of this culture that we've come here to examine. So with that, we will move on to our panelists. And we have Jordan, who will focus us on the classroom and kind of traditional pedagogy, or in non-traditional ways. Karen, who will explicitly help us think about academic journals and some organizations related to those journals, and Laura, who will focus us on some issues of public advocacy around issues that matter for the particular communities that we're focusing on here. So with that, thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Jordan Gilbertson. I'm a third-year law student at the University of Laverne in Ontario, California. Today I am presenting how to integrate fan-created works into the teaching of copyright law. I'm hoping to have an interactive experience with you guys today. I have some examples towards the end here of fan-created works of a piece of fanfic, a vid, and then a song, not necessarily a quilt. And I'd like to maybe engage in discourse a little bit with some of the audience members about whether or not these are infringing and if they are defendable, just like you would in a regular classroom. But before we get into integration, I think it's helpful if we have a brief overview, since there's a lot of lawyers and law professors in the room, but for those of us who aren't, if we have just a brief overview of traditional law school pedagogy, as well as some feminist critiques thereof. The two, and forgive me, I'm terrible at saying the term pedagogy and pedagogical. I'm horrible at it. two tools that are entrenched in the traditional law school experience are case briefing and the Socratic method. Case briefing is a staple of legal education since Christopher Columbus Langdell introduced the technique in the 1870s. Basically, students are assigned cases to read that have been abridged and put into case books to illustrate a particular point of law. Students then distill the case down to its core components, identifying the key facts and the procedural history of the case, the issue which may or may not have been the important issue before the court or even the only issue before the court, as well as the court's holding and their reasoning for doing so. By doing that, students then utilize those components and distill out a rule of law in which they can apply to similar fact situations. To supplement case briefing, we have the dread Socratic method. My favorite quote has been bandied about a lot and basically says, if Socrates actually used this method, he would have taken the hemlock a lot faster. Basically, the Socratic method supplements case briefing and consists of extended questioning of a single student about a case, and it's designed to explore the concepts addressed in the case more fully and more deeply. It forces all students, not just women or men, to engage in the learning process as active participants. In order to prepare for the Socratic dialogue that is inevitable in law school, students must be attentive in their briefing. They must be active listeners and quick and critical thinkers, which is what you also need to be if you're going to be an attorney. This particular method is exemplified by, like I said, extended questioning of single students, as well as frequent interruption by the professors, additional hypothetical facts or altering of the facts in the case, and a tone that can often be called confrontational and sometimes just downright hostile or mean, depending on how your professor is feeling that day and how you're acting in class. Some professors have recognized some inherent inadequacies in the Socratic method and have shifted or have also added voluntary participation to supplement the method. But as we will see in just a moment, even this is subject to the same critiques that that the Socratic method is. There have been studies conducted over the last 20 years that have studies of law schools conducted over the last 20 years that have overwhelmingly concluded that female students participate in classroom dialogue less than their male counterparts. And feminist educational theorists have wondered why that is. Various feminist scholars have theorized that one reason for the disparity is the Socratic method. The Socratic method has, in their mind, one of two fatal flaws for the female student. The first is that the Socratic method fosters characteristics inherent in men. Generally, women tend to be community or relationship-oriented, valuing their relationships and acting in a non-assertive and agreeable manner, often stating their opinion and ceding the floor so that other students can also be part of the discourse and dialogue. Women students tend to be sensitive towards others' learning and others' participation. But the Socratic method does not reward that kind of learning. The Socratic method rewards those who act in assertive, argumentative, and confrontational manners, often traditionally associated with men. The second critique is that the method was created by a man when the law was only men, and its continued use perpetuates the male-dominated legal hierarchy. Supporters of the second theory advocate a complete overhaul of the law school pedagogy, which has yet to catch fire, but some professors do take this critique very seriously and try to implement certain feminist educational theories and concepts into their classroom experience. To go along with the Socratic method is voluntariness. There's been four theories as to why women do not participate as much as men do. The first is fear. Women are afraid to speak out, afraid of being shamed or shunned or made fun of. The second would be professorial bias. There's a hesitance to engage or challenge female students, and there's more tension and deference to students, as noted above, who demonstrate traditional male characteristics. There's also a lack of interest in the battle for classroom dominance, which is inherent, I think, in the law school setting. Everybody wants to prove that they're the best, whether or not that is actually the case. And last theory is silent protest against the male dominance of the law school tradition. Case briefing, on the other hand, in my research has come up against little to no criticism. I could be wrong, and I would be happy for somebody to supplement this theory, but I propose that there's little criticism for this teaching tool because, boiled down, cases are just stories. And at its most basic, feminist pedagogy suggests that women's learning is enhanced by utilizing stories, both personal and public. Case briefing and case books fit into feminist pedagogy, but case briefing is still ill-suited for the teaching of cutting-edge areas such as intellectual property law, because cases are chopped and abridged and read out of context. In doing so, cases are often behind the times, and IP law needs to be ahead of the times. In an area like fan-created works, there are very few cases actually litigating the status as infringing or not infringing, and if so infringing, are they defensible? So I'm proposing selectively integrating these works into teaching copyright for two reasons. The first being that fan-created works are on the cutting edge of intellectual property law. Before I was a law student, I was a fan, and as a law student, I've become even more of a fan because, goodness gracious, I need something to do that isn't legal. I believe that as fandom is growing and becoming and is becoming geek chic, if you will, there are looming intellectual property issues that are going to be litigated, and if students are not fans, if you have students who aren't fans, they're going to go out and be intellectual property lawyers. How are they going to be able to tell what is fandom, and how are they going to be able to litigate whether or not, on either side, it's infringing, it's not infringing, if they don't know what it is? My second theory is that certain aspects of fandom, as were discussed today, fitting to some extent filking, fan craft, fan fiction, and the creation of this user-generated content are dominated by women. I would take a class in which the entire class was supplemented with fan-created works, but I'm not proposing such a drastic measure. But I think that it would pique the interest of women, both in taking intellectual property survey courses or more specified courses like copyright, patent, trademark, if we utilized some of these materials and gave women a sense of connection. Okay, so there are two. We all know that copyright will subsist in original works of authority of authorship based on a tangible medium of expression. Everybody who teaches intellectual property law knows that. So I'm proposing that there are two concepts that are susceptible to integration of fan-created works. The first being transformative use, and the second being fair use. Obviously, that is the defense that is levied most of the time against these allegations of infringement. But it's fair, but we're not doing it for money, but we've transformed it into something wholly and completely different. And so it's here that I'm asking for your help. I'd like to briefly show you three separate pieces of fan-created works. And I would like to go through brief analysis and maybe try to hash out whether or not they're infringing, and whether or not, if they are infringing, they are transformative or fair use. The first is a piece of fan fiction that a friend of mine let me use, but she asked not to be identified. She says it's not her best work. So please just take a moment. It's only 108 words. It's a drabble only, probably not probably not by some standards. It has to be only 100 words. Take a moment and let me know when you guys are done.
Can anybody identify the fandom?
I am not a Doctor Who fan. I'm not that I don't like it. I've just never seen it. I didn't have BBC. I don't have BBC America, and I feel terrible for it. So the first question that we ask is it infringing? If the work isn't infringing, then there is no problem. It's going to be an original piece of authorship that is able to have its own copyright. So the question is there an ownership of a registered copyright here? Obviously, Doctor Who is a copyrighted work. Is there copying from the owner's work? Anyone? Anyone think that there is or is not copying from the owner's work, and why? Nobody wants to help me out? Okay, I can call on people. We can do this Socratically.
There are allusions to visual things like the trainers and the leather jacket. To me, that's 10 and then 9.
And the scarf.
The leather jacket is actually an allusion to the Eighth Doctor novels, which are a licensed Transformer work. That was Fitzcarner's costume in the novels. So.
Okay, so we're believing that what we're saying is that it's pretty clear that the person who wrote this had access to not just the television show, but also other works in the Doctor Who fandom. And is there substantial similarity? Is the fact that this author uses the trainers, the scarf, regeneration, as a companion, are these things substantially similar to the original work? Anyone have an argument against it? Why it couldn't be considered that way?
Change in medium, right?
Change in medium?
You need to know the context. You don't know yet, right? Because the name never gets mentioned.
And that's a very big element of it, is the fact that if you didn't know Doctor Who, like I did, and I said, oh, this is really interesting, I wonder what this is about. She said, it's Doctor Who. I said, oh, okay, good to know. So there's a question of whether or not it's substantially similar. And then, are the elements of the work taken amount to improper appropriation? No? So we're going to say that this piece of fan fiction is not infringing. Therefore, we don't have to go through a transformative or a fair use analysis. The second piece I'd like to show is a vid, which was already brought up, which is wonderful. It would be Us by Lim, which is my absolute favorite piece of art that's out there currently. If you wouldn't mind, Stacey. I'm just going to watch it.
My sound didn't come on.
God, dang. It worked earlier, just like before. We're going to be going through the same analysis again, so if anybody needs the important say. I'm just going to watch a little bit of it. I'm pretty sure that everyone here is person. Wonderful song, and I love the opening anyway. For time's sake, I could watch this on loop all day long. Pretty much anything Lim does, I could watch on loop all day long. So the question then becomes, this particular piece would once again be supplement to a case, or you would perhaps design an entire day of curriculum around fibs or fanfic. So the question becomes, is it infringing? Do the pieces used in many, many pieces of many different works infringe on registered copyrights? Is there copying from the owner's work? But really, this particular piece, I think, goes to the question of transformativeness. Does it add something new to the original? Does it alter the work with a new expression, meaning, or message? I'm sorry, but when I watch that, I do not think Star Trek, Buffy, Serenity, or anything else. As was said last night and today in the previous panels, that is a whole, that particular piece, to me, I would argue, is not about the video, and it's not about the music. It's about the combining of the two to create something completely different and new, to create a visual experience that invokes things that I've never thought could by seeing Kirk and Spock on a street or a mountaintop. But this is the kind of discourse that I think that can be engaged in a traditional law school class, creating some sort of invoking a familiarity, but also a sense of connection to the material and having people and having students, particularly female students, engage in the material. The last piece that I'd like to show is arguably a filk, but I'm not sure. The song is, before we start, the song is called Ralph Wiggum. It's by the Bloodhound Gang. We're just going to assume for today's purposes that it wasn't licensed, that the use of the materials wasn't licensed. I'm sure it was. It was put out by a major record label. There's hoops that must be jumped through. Go ahead, please. That works. That stops it. I first heard this song, my brother played it for me, and I had absolutely no clue what it was about. I asked him to turn it off. I thought it was horrible. It took me 4 listens to actually understand, and as you go through, if you heard the whole song, it's songs from WAP. I have to end, but this would be another thing that you could add. There are quotes from 19 seasons of The Simpsons utilized. Singular quotes throughout make up the entirety of the lyrics, and so that would be another... Is it fair use? I think that goes to the question of, is it fair use? So I hope that this kind of brings to light ways in which fan-created works can be utilized in traditional classrooms. Thank you.
Karen Hellickson, and I'm here in my capacity as co-editor of a journal called Transformative Works and Cultures. We just published our second issue. Our call for papers is right there on the end of that table, so feel free to grab one and submit early, submit often. All right, I'm going to talk a lot about, I'm going to be using acronyms too, so let me define acronyms for a moment. TWC, Transformative Works and Cultures, is the journal. It also stands for the Weather Channel, as I discovered when we were researching what we could use for our website. OTW is the Organization for Transformative Works, and that's the parent organization under the umbrella of which we publish. And I myself work in the STM market, the scientific, technical, and medical market. So I'm going to bandy those acronyms about as though you know what they mean, because now you do. All right. With Christina Bussa, my co-editor of Transformative Works and Cultures right there, I edited a book a while ago about fan fiction and other fan expressions in the age of the internet. And it was an important book in that it was the first book to kind of talk about internet stuff in a way that hadn't been done before. And I think on the basis of that project, Christina and I were asked by the Organization of Transformative Works, OTW, to co-edit their academic journal. OTW had a series, it's a fan advocacy group, formed out of the fire of something horrible that happened. And the fans decided that they needed to band together and create their own organization so that we could own the servers, so that we could own our own stuff, so that things couldn't be taken away from us by corporate entities. So thus was OTW born. And OTW has a number of projects under development right now. I won't really talk about those because the journal is really the most important one. But the academic journal is one of them, and it was one of the first ones to go live. And when I was asked about the possibility of editing this journal, my first thing was no, because I'm really busy. I don't really have time. And the other thing was, why do we need a new journal? This planet has quite a few scholarly journals, and we really probably don't need another one unless there's some clear and present need for it. And they were able to convince me that there was a clear and present need for this journal, and I went ahead and signed up, which meant we were starting something from scratch, which meant we had to pick copyright, which meant we had to think about how we were going to disseminate it, who was going to subscribe, all sorts of big questions that I hadn't really thought about. I've been working in the STM market since 1996, because I really am that old. And I had a lot of opinions about what can and can't be done, and a lot of that's born out of what I have to do for a living. But OTW had actually a very liberal take on fair use and remixing, and that is, of course, because so many of the fan artworks that you've been seeing and hearing about are transformative in nature, using copyrighted materials. And so OTW had a pretty liberal use of what constituted fair use. And they had lawyers, like Rebecca, to back us up. So if somebody gets sued or whatever, or if somebody's, you know, if somebody is feeling some effects of legal chill, like maybe they get a takedown notice from YouTube or whatever, OTW can be there to advise. And once I realized that we could actually, it wouldn't be just another scholarly journal, but one with some really interesting things about it, I was on board. I was really on board. And the whole gender aspect of this is actually pervasive throughout the entire project. I think it's inseparable from the community of women that banded together to form OTW. The journal grew out of that, and the ethos is pervasive throughout the entire way we structured it. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. One thing that we noticed was happening is that the women's role in creating transformative artworks has kind of been erased. And Francesca talked about this last night, where people were talking about these male-generated forms like machinima, which is like fan vids created through like Halo or whatever. And those were getting a lot of attention, and those tend to be created by men. And people were treating them as though they were some brand new thing, and of course women have been bidding for a lot longer than that. And it was clear that unless we set something up to talk about our own stuff, we would get erased, and that was really uncool. So we needed to create a forum for that. So part of the genesis of the project was to slow the speed of this erasure, and in fact to stop the erasure altogether. So TWC's role within the OTW is, one important thing is we want to be able to link fans and scholars. And lots of people here are both. We call ourselves ACCA fans. We're both simultaneously. But there's plenty of people who are just one or just the other. And this is kind of a place where both can meet. Fans have always written criticism. They call it we call it meta. And academics have always written criticism, and they call it criticism. But it's the same thing as meta. Fans also create artworks that I argue are actually critical analyses. All of the artworks that we've seen are actually a form of criticism. And when I write slash fan fiction, which I do a lot, I am actually writing a form of criticism about the primary text. It's just taking a creative bent as opposed to a heavily sourced, non-creative bent. But the link between the two is actually really tight. And the audience, it's basically a difference in audience, meta versus scholarly article. They're pretty much the same thing. They're sourced, they allude to one another, people are familiar with a lot of it and talk about certain meta pieces as being particularly famous. A good example is Rachel Sabatini's analysis of fans as gift culture, a short piece published in the Fanfic Symposium, probably I think in 96 maybe, I don't really remember. And that's just a good example. I mean, everybody knows Rachel's essay, and when I gave a paper on gift culture, everybody's asking me about it, you know, so yeah, I've read it. Let's talk about how I'm taking her idea and going a little bit further with it. One really important thing that TWC did, or was created to do, is to provide legitimacy to the larger project. Because there's all sorts of legitimacy in academic discourse. It's very privileged in our culture, partially I think because a lot of it's still in print. I'm hoping that'll change, but because of the print base, has a lot of authority. And it's providing, it's sort of like propping up a little bit of OTW, because on the one hand, you have the creative artworks, which are sort of confusingly on the edge of legality, but pretty much criticism, everybody knows that. You can cite things, and that's not a problem. You can publish a still, and that's an illustration. That falls within fair use. That's pretty well understood. So we're providing a context for a lot of that stuff, analysis of those kinds of things to happen. And we're also, we're going to be backed up by a legal team, so if any of the stuff we do is on the edge, we will hope that we will be able to defend ourselves. So TWC and OTW are really inextricably bound, but I do want to emphasize that the editorial board is totally separate, the editorial team is totally separate, and OTW has nothing to do with what we publish. They sponsor us, and they pay for our servers, and that's actually a really important thing to do. Now, my background. For a living, what I do is I'm a copy editor in the scientific, technical, and medical market, although I also edit books for university presses. And this is actually relevant, because when you guys publish, it's going to go to some sort of production manager who has no background in copyright, who's going to tell you what you can and can't do. So, like, I edit a book for Indiana University Press, and the author uses song lyrics as their epigraphs. I strike those. I have standing instructions, just cut those. No song lyrics at all. Get rid of them. I also have to double check certain things, like if they have artwork, and this is more an issue in the scholarly or the scientific essays I edit. Sometimes an author will include a figure that has been published elsewhere, and very often that figure is by the author himself. He just is reusing something he'd already published. He mistakenly thinks that he can use that as many times as he wants because he created it, but he can't because he signed over the copyright to the journal when he published the original article, and I need to pay $500 to use that figure again in a reprint. So I have to keep my eye out for that. I'm also, I think, like the only person who reads the thing all the way through. I think most people in scholarly discourse especially, they read the introduction or the abstract, and they read the results, and that's pretty much it. And I read the whole thing, and you know, I analyze the references, make sure they're in style. But basically, somebody with no background in law is going to be deciding what's appropriate for you to publish, and we self-censor. So if there's anything that's going to be problematic, we don't even have a conversation about it. We just cut it. And if you want it, then you got to pay for it. So the press is not going to incur the fee. If you want to cite song lyrics, like Stephen King does this all the time in his books, and if you open up to the copyright page, there's a little section of who he contacted to get permission. Stephen King paid for that. His press didn't pay for that. Of course, Stephen King is pretty wealthy, so I'm sure it's no big deal. But somebody had to do the research and find out who owned the copyright, which in a lot of older sons especially is really tough, and get permission, and you say how big your print run is, and all this stuff happens. But it's going to be the author who has to incur that expense, and that research, the people who work in the production side of things will not take care of that for you. So I'm very, you know, restrictive. Strike the song lyrics. Make sure those figures are properly attributed, and sometimes there's special wording the copyright holder requires be used. And publishers are always on the lookout for anything that's going to cost and anything that they can be sued over. And I have had several authors successfully reinstate song lyrics in their essays by after having a conversation with somebody, not me, somebody more important than me, who can then decide that it falls within fair use. But the author doesn't get to decide that, and I don't get to decide that. It's like a communal decision of other people. And the author can have it if he can pay. I call this whole big self-censoring thing just like legal chill. And I have read, there's a publisher, and I can't think of their name right now. Maybe I shouldn't even name them if I could remember. They don't permit, they publish media studies books, and I had to write a book review for one. They won't permit dialogue to be quoted. They won't permit episode titles to be provided. They won't permit plot summaries, and they won't permit screenshots. So I'd like a close analysis of Star Trek Deep Space Nine without using any of those things. That's a bad argument. You know, there's no support, there's no illustration, there's things I want to see that I'm not seeing. And it's all because of the legal chill. There's like legal precedence for some of those things happening, and they just don't want to take any chances. So they're going to publish a bad book. And, you know, I'm actually not okay with that. I think that if you're going to be that restrictive, then you need to find another publisher. That's, of course, often easier said than done. But the result of this sort of legal chill and fear and the over-policing by people like me is that work is not being done because it literally cannot be published. Nobody will consider it. And that's where TWC comes in. Yes, we'll consider it. We would love to print your screenshot. If you have an embedded video, bring it on. We'd love it. The more the better. And color is so expensive. When I worked in-house at a publishing house, I'd see people, authors writing checks for $30,000 to have a color signature so that their colors could be printed in, so their figures could be printed in color. And that's a lot of money. And a lot of them are getting grants to help pay for that, but that's a lot of money. So the ability to print all these multimedia aspects and have color, it's kind of like unbeatable. But if work is not being done because it literally won't be considered for print because of the legal chill, and I think that's a serious disservice to our culture. And it was concerns like that that I was thinking about when it came time to decide what we should do for copyright for TWC. We need to move beyond a self-censoring mode, and we need to move beyond print. Frankly, we really need to move beyond print. A lot of the journals I work on now have special articles that are video things, like they'll show a surgery being performed to show this new method of surgery, but it's never within the context of an essay. It's always its own special thing, like a video extra, and it will never appear in print. But I do occasionally see things like that, but I don't see a lot of mixing it up within the essays themselves. It's basically just print converted to the screen, and the same file is used to typeset the whole thing. Oh my God, 5 minutes. All right, let me race through. The scientific, technical, and medical model is relevant here because they are the ones who pioneered open access. And I'm using open access in a very specific sense. I don't mean anybody can see it for free. I mean that it meets a very specific, rigid criteria so we can call ourselves open access and get listed on open access listings. And this is rare in the humanities. The best example known out there is Public Library of Science PLOS Biology. And they are a Creative Commons copyright. And they pay for everything via page fees. So if you get an article accepted in PLOS Biology, you'll pay $2,850. But you won't. It'll be your affiliated, the university you're affiliated with, or the grant that you've written. But basically, you're going to be charging a page fee in order to publish it, and then have everything paid for, and then it's open access forever for everybody always. And that's the sort of model that I was looking at when we were thinking about what copyright we wanted. And in fact, TWC did choose Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported, which means you are free to share this. You can copy, distribute, and transmit it. You can remix it. You can adapt it under the following conditions. You must attribute the work and non-commercial. You may not use this work for commercial purposes. Now, PLOS Biology doesn't even have the non-commercial thing. If somebody wants to make money off it, they can. They don't care. The reason we chose not to do that was because of our audience, because we figure enough people are making money off the unpaid labor of fan women, the least they could do is ask. And we always say yes, and we don't charge a fee, and we have been asked, and we did say yes, and we didn't charge a fee. But we want to be able to control it, and we want to tell the author. And the journal holding the copyright is normal in the industry, so we do hold the copyright. We make all the authors who submit, who are accepted, fill out a form that gives us the copyright. And then what we do with that is, you know, we file it. The authors are then free to do whatever they want with the essay. If they want to blog it at their own site, that's fine. And they're welcome to do that. If they want to publish it somewhere, even if, it's, of course, it's their very own paper, if they want to publish it in an edited volume, perhaps, of their own work, then they have to ask our permission because they're going to make money, and we'll say yes. But we did this for a whole bunch of reasons. One, authors have a way of disappearing off the face of the planet, so this way it's easy. Another, it's standard in the industry. If people want to copy something, they will ask us, and they won't ask the author, and that's normal. So we're just falling within, you know, accepted usage within the journal field. But the whole idea of remixing, we were particularly eager to see if that would ever happen, and in fact it did. After our first issue came out, it's online only, right? Online only. We have videos, we have screenshots, and somebody wanted to make a PDF. So we said sure, because that's fair use remix. They didn't even have to ask. It would have been fine if they'd just done it. But she made a PDF and she made it available, and we blogged about it and linked to it. It was really nice. You know, I've never really before seen anybody want to take something dynamic and make it static, but if she wants to do that, that's fine. And it was nice that she asked, because she numbered the pages, and I was worried that people would get hold of the PDF and think it was official. And we don't number pages because it's online only. We number all the paragraphs so that people can cite easily. So I told her, you know, if you want feedback, please remove the page numbers so that people don't mistakenly cite this thinking it's official. And once again, that leads to the primacy of print. Another important thing we did, since I have to wrap this up, we chose an open source software platform called OJS, which stands for Open Journal System. It's out of Canada, and a lot of journals use this, but we chose it for a whole bunch of reasons, but the main reason we picked it, at least in my mind, was because it permits commenting. When the article is published, you can go and leave a comment, and that's important to our audience. We're writing about ourselves, and we're writing for ourselves, and the community that we were coming out of, this female-dominated community, wants to comment on each other's work, and we would rather not the conversation be moved to a private blog. We would rather have the conversation threaded through at the site itself. So we chose this particular software. It's very well known. A lot of journals use it. It also lets the whole thing go through production from submission to through peer review to print without having to break it up into a number of different platforms, and it permits us to embed the HTML pretty easily. Of course, it's also based on a print model, and it's geared for PDFs, so we have to do some kludgy stuff to make it work, but it's a great platform, and I really recommend it. And I also appreciate that we're using something open access to generate something open access, so it's like we're, you know, kind of giving back to the whole community. As a non-affiliated academic, I realize how frustrating it is for people who are not affiliated to gain access to peer-reviewed content. If I do the simplest search, I can't get it. I get firewalled out. I need a subscription. I need a password. I need something. And there's also a lot of moratoriums, even at NIH. If you get funding through NIH, you have to deposit your essay in a particular place for open access because you received federal funds. They have a one-year moratorium, and that was totally the publishers that did that. So we don't have anything like that. We have no moratorium. Everything immediately goes to print. It's all open access, and that's great for scholars, and it also means that we're going to get cited more often. Research has shown that if something is open access, it's 3 times more likely to get cited than something in any other source. So I guess my take-home message for this is consider TWC for all your publishing needs. But the other is, if you're ever in a position as an academic to push something through where you have the ability to say, well, maybe we should try open access, it's really, I think the current publishing method, print-based method, is really stifling of creativity and stifling of all the things that I see going on in this room, and I don't want that. I want us to be free to talk with each other and to comment and to have a conversation. And a lot of this stuff is being enabled by the open access model. Thank you.
I got the call for papers for this symposium at a moment when I was beginning to get quite dissatisfied about some of the elements of public discussion of copyright in Canada. And it was a strange moment to... wait, no, my paper isn't working. Just all these little... It was a strange moment to get dissatisfied because it was quite an exciting moment in terms of public awareness of copyright issues in Canada. In June 2008, the Conservative government introduced some fairly egregious copyright legislation in terms of users' rights, public interest issues, educational, library, creators' issues. And for the first time, really, there was a large public outcry, and this was facilitated to some extent by a Facebook group that I'll talk about shortly. And so to those of us who've been working in copyright both as scholars and as advocates for some time, it was gratifying to see this, but I found myself increasingly disengaged from this discussion. And I'm kind of used to being a little bit, this just isn't working from here right now. So I'm going to need somebody to, would you just sit there, Angie, and just move it? you can move it right now. Probably, yeah. And to some extent, I'm used to being an outsider because I'm not a lawyer or a law professor in these discussions, but you can turn it again. And you can turn it again. but I started to think about gender issues as well, because I had spent, as I said, a fair amount of time being aware of not being a lawyer and that kind of dynamic. But I started to think, hey, you know what? There aren't a lot of women, at least on this side of the podium either, and started to want to think about what degree this may, what connection this might have with political strategy and scholarly adequacy in the field of copyright. So you can turn it again. What I have undertaken to do, and I really didn't get this finished before the symposium, so I've got preliminary results, is first of all, I looked at this Facebook group called Fair Copyright for Canada. I counted its membership and the participation in its discussions, and then I looked at the nature of the discussions in that group. I've been interviewing participants in IP advocacy in Canada, and also some IP professors who aren't so involved in the public discussions. And then just as I was in the middle of getting this all started, a new documentary came out, put out by the National Film Board of Canada called RIP, or R-I-P, a remix documentary, a remix manifesto, and I couldn't refrain from talking about that because it seemed to raise so many gender issues for me. So this paper doesn't directly speak to the kind of fan-vidding issues here, except there's a couple of brief moments of fandom I'll talk about. But I think that in a way, at least in its general sense, it shows how important the work on fan-vidding is, because it shows certain trends in the public discussion that are really not picking up on the full range of work for which certain copyright laws would be a big problem. Can we move on? Oh, I really wish this was working. It would be so much easier for me to do it. Click it again. So I'm talking about several different circles here. One of them is public interest copyright advocates. Another one is IP faculty members, and there's an overlap, substantial overlap there in Canada. And then the third circle, which is much bigger but harder to measure, is concerned citizens. And so the first thing I did is I wanted to figure out, well, was I right when I had this impression that there were more men than women involved in these circles? And so I counted, and I found out that as for IP academics, in fact, a third of them are women in Canada. And the public interest advocates, a third of them are women if you measure them according to the ways I did. And if you look at Facebook as one archive, or the word artifact was used earlier, I think that's an interesting one, an artifact of discussion. You count the membership of that group called Fair Copyright for Canada, and you find out that it's a third women too. So my first result was kind of negative in a sense. I thought, actually, there's lots of women here. But then when we look at the Facebook page a little bit more closely, we see a different pattern when it comes to discussion. And you can click again. When I did my first count, I found 11% women in the discussions on this page. I think that's actually a very high number, because if I had counted instead of participants, posts, I would have gotten a much higher percentage of men, because it's been my observation, which I haven't quite, you know, done all the counting for, that men repeat post much more than women do. So women will, you know, say something once or twice, and then, having made their point, retreat. And so the 11% is really probably not quite accurate in terms of the representation. And you can click again. So of course I wanted to think about why this was, and some ideas about that have already been put forth today. And I wanted to think about what the effects and implications of it are. So one of the people I interviewed was one of the, there are only two women who've been active in these, persistently active in these Facebook discussions. And so one of them, when I interviewed her, this is what she said. She said, by definition, the discussion cannot be balanced and inclusive if the perspective of over half of the population is not being equally represented or heard. A 2008 Angus Reid poll on Bill C-61, that same bill, stated that only 29% of women polled opposed Bill C-61 as opposed to 49% of men. That concerned me. Does that represent a lack of knowledge, interest, or engagement on the part of Canadian women on copyright issues, or a valid, informed gender difference of opinion? And, you know, those are basically my questions to begin with as well. Dealing with the last part of her question first, My strong contention would be that there is no particular reason, and all your research would back this up as well, why men would care more about users' rights than women. And in the particular case of the history of Canadian public interest advocacy, I would say that it was librarians who carried the torch for users' rights in many, many years when nobody else was paying attention to this. So librarians and the educational community have been quite vociferous, and these are dominated by women. So, and then you add to the fact that women have cell phones too that they might want to unlock. I'm going to assume that this is an issue that there would be no particular reason why men and women would feel differently about it. Then we get to the question of knowledge, interest, or engagement. And as I suggested before, when I talked about Facebook as an artifact of discussion, we can measure, say, participation in that group. But it's much harder to measure other kinds of conversations that happen in other, coffee lounges or restaurants or any other kinds of circles that don't have documentation. But you may have other suggestions about that. And then if we don't have documentation of engagement, it's even harder to measure interest or knowledge. So you can turn next. This is just to give a bit of a feel for the Facebook group. Here we have Connor saying, "I hate the bill." By the way, the bill didn't pass, but more or less by accident. That is to say, the government fell. There was an election. This is what happens in Canada. We had this long, very helpful series of minority governments that have prevented Canada from following the U.S. DMCA-style path. But it's kind of random. It's not necessarily because we're really catching on to the problems. So Connor says, "I hate the bill because of restrictions it places on things we paid for and restrictions it places upon my lifestyle of copying things, backing them up, hacking files to make them better, and getting cool, innovative products that let you do impressive technological things." There's a lot of emotional investment in this issue on the part of the participants in the page. And I like, there's something kind of guileless about this thing. I let you do impressive technological things. So let you display yourself to other people in what is often being coded as a masculine way, right? Next. Or more succinctly, "The stuff is mine and they're limiting my rights to use it." So many feminist critics have pointed out the ways that some of this kind of property discourse and liberal individualism is gendered. And I'm going to just give you my first brief clip of the film now, because it is an example of another kind of discourse you see a lot on the website. It needs sound. I'll tell you what the words were above that for now and keep going, but if you can, I need the sound later on, more importantly. Anyway, what it says is, this movie is about a war about ideas, and I take that personal because so it's something about the internet, because I was born in the same year as the internet, and there's this very kind of punchy music there, and what I'll say more generally about this film is I think it's very astute in understanding a certain kind of audience and speaking to that audience, but one of my questions about it is the extent to which it reinforces certain exclusions. By being so politically astute, it's also being politically blind. That's my suggestion about it. Okay, you can go on to the next slide. So if the discourse is gendered, which of course I don't have time to amplify further now, why don't women change it? You know, Facebook, lots of women are on Facebook. Why isn't it changing? Go to the next slide. One of my most interesting interviews was with a male university student who's very, very engaged in resistance to this bill and copyright advocacy. And he's making his own documentary for a class. And he said this: "Downloading songs for free or cutting up clips from a movie, it seems that women don't really care if it would be illegal or not. It's kind of, I'll do whatever I want type thing because I can, rather than," and this is the male voice, he's saying, "oh, there are rules, screw the rules. I enjoy breaking boundaries and such." "I don't know," he said, "if it's a lack of maturity or it's a lack of understanding, but it just seems that women in university are more carefree about, say, ownership and property laws." And You know, this is one of the problems about silence, although it may be, as you suggested, sometimes a political strategy in these situations, is that it is often interpreted to be lack of maturity or lack of understanding. And in fairness to this interviewee, he does recognize that there's a problem. He recognizes a kind of gap, you know, between his discourse and some other parties. And then I cut this clip before, but I put it back in. If we've got sound, have we got sound? We think we have sound?
1 second, let me try this
over. I'll try. Just press the next slide then and see if that works.
Yeah, we just love.
Can you make it louder? So they're in China, in the back of a car. This is the filmmaker, Brett Gaylor, and so he's showing his movie in fast motion to Lessig, and Lessig says it's fantastic, it's totally illegal. Okay, can you go to the next slide? So the coolest lawyer in the world just told me I'm making an illegal film. There's a lot of fandom in this movie. In fact, one of my interviewees pointed out, a communications professor, that it's about a boy in love with a rock star. But it's also, I think, about a boy in love with a lawyer. So there's a slash version that really could be made here. I wish the sound was working better. But it's a really, really strong thread in the film, which is we'll talk about in a second. So let's go on to the next slide. This is the same student that I quoted from before. In our production class, we actually get a lot more conceptual questions from the women in our class, and then the technical aspects about how to actually show how severe Bill C-61 was were from the guys in the class. The girls, they say, oh, well, what about this question, or what about this issue, or are you going to talk on this subject? And he says, oh, you can go down in so many different alleys, but we had a limited time. And he says, we're trying to make this film to show people that a bill had passed, which hadn't actually passed, so we have to really scare them. That was the gist of what he was saying. And the girls, he said, were just not knowledgeable about this. So he had picked a strategy for his film, for his production class, which was to do a speculative documentary. The speculative documentary then demanded a certain kind of sensationalist or, you know, very punchy kind of presentation. But the student wasn't really aware, in a sense, that he'd made that choice. And having made that choice of genre, he had to follow a certain kind of logic of analysis. And so he's frustrated by the kind of gender divide. So again, I see that as his observations, you know, on the one hand are quite insightful, but then the conclusions that he draws from them are quite troubling. Sorry about this, because I embedded the video in the thing. I couldn't move it to a PC. So I also talked to, as I said, a bunch of intellectual property professors and asked them some of these same questions about, you know, is there a gender bias in these circles, and if so, why do you think, and so on. So this is one answer. A female IP professor said, women tend to self-censor more if they get a news person contacting them to speak about X and it's not directly in their area, whereas men might go out more on a limb, which may actually be the right choice. It is true that there are very few women IP professors who do speak publicly on these issues or are quoted publicly, and there are none of them who blog in Canada. I'm the only woman blogger on copyright, and I'm not a law professor. But there are many of them who are actively publishing and very, very senior, but have not been operating in these circles. Next slide. I feel so retro to be saying next slide. It's like an art history class. Okay. And another one said, where I am effective and where I work well is in teams with groups. I don't need to be the one out there. I need to know I'm part of a group that's contributing to the greater good. My comfort level increases the more I feel part of a larger group. This last sentence here sounds like something out of a personality test or something, where, you know, you put the little pencil mark in a circle at the end. Anyway, I thought, well, you know, this is interesting, because there's all this emphasis on how And it came up in other interviews with women as well that they wanted to be working in groups more. I was thinking, but the discourse about the remix is all about groups too. So here's another clip from the documentary.
So far, this film has been mixed and remixed to the point where 64 university students even got together to make an animated version. So now I've got a posse, and we're creating this movie together. Whenever you see this song, you'll know that this piece of video came from someone else. Maybe it came from you.
These are communities that are being created by the opportunity this technology makes available. And these communities engage in a kind of conversation, each one taking what the other had done and adding to it, mixing it and changing it, and engaging in a creative act.
So we have the language of community happening in both places, but you'll see that here it's a posse. And also, there's a bit of mystification about, in my view, both on the filmmaker's part and on Lessig's, about what causes community. It's not technology in this case, but in fact it was a course. These university students who got together to remix this film were asked to do so by their professor. So there we have the educational institution in fostering a kind of creativity for which it's not given credit. It's really just comes from the air somehow. It comes from the technology. So the questions that arise and many of you have asked and talked about before, Ari, you can go to the next slide. What kind of community are we talking about? What kind of conversation? What kind of creative act? We'll see if this works. All right. I'll just leave that for now. So this is the film, and I'll conclude by just a few more clips because I can't resist. The main character in the film, in a sense, is the DJ Girl Talk, an ironic name in the sense that the film is quite long, and there are only two girls who talk in it. And I'm going to show you two of the two lead girls in the movie right now.
Well, what is the mall club? Who would have a problem with Girl Talks music?
I've been at the Copyright Office for more than 40 years. You want to know, I don't have a computer at home. I've never done a mashup. I've actually never downloaded a song that was hanging out there.
Can I show you a mashup?
Sure.
So, just grab any one of those, paste that into a new window, Elvis Costello Radio. So, I just highlight the first kind of percussion hit. So if I put 0.25 seconds of it there, then paste 0.125 seconds of it, which is half of that, I'll paste the 0.25 seconds again. So this is 1 second now, and this should be on Elvis. Put in 0.125 seconds of silence. Put it twice as 0.25 seconds of silence. Paste it 0.25 seconds again.
Okay.
Paste it 0.125 seconds. This is a lot of copyright.
Well, no, I'm just amazed at what he's doing.
His notes and rearranging them. The minimal version.
Okay. Is who would have a problem with Girl Talk's music? And it's a beautifully edited movie, very stylish, I should say, and so on. But what happens first is you see a picture of the Capitol. I'll just say as an aside, it's interesting. It's a Canadian movie, but it's really about American law, which makes it have a wider audience, but it has a whole other issue is what its implications are for the Canadian legal situation. But anyway, so who would have a problem with this? You see an image of the Capitol, then you see a hallway, and you hear clicking high heels going down the hallway. Then you see Mary Beth Peters. So in other words, she's the one who has an issue with Girl Talk's music. Well, this is not the case. The people who might have issues with Girl Talk's music are the owners of that music, the copyright executives who are actually men. So a woman is being put in the position of being a bad guy and also being old and unhip and all these other kinds of things. And then meanwhile, we have Girl Talk's girlfriend in the bed which again was a choice on the part of the filmmaker. I mean, maybe she was there, but you know, maybe that didn't or did have to be used in the film. Girl Tops Girl, as she is named later in the film, does get a couple of lines. You'll see one in a minute. And Girl Tops Mom gets a line, and a little Brazilian girl gets a line, and those are all the women in the movie. This is one other. This is the last woman in the movie. So there's some fandom. And then this is the last, my last instance of femininity I could find in the film.
Rather than letting the law decide what you can and can't do, now some corporate software will decide for you.
I just call it the idea of the fact that business model. Right? It used to be that like when the CEO, all the uses of it flowed freely and easily. But with the new regime for DRM, every new use flows in a small, painful, spurting grin, right? Every time you press a button, you'll know that another 3 cents out of your pocket for the new rewinding, right? And the new pausing, right? And the new, you know, walking into your minivan, right?
So, I don't know if I would have thought of this if I hadn't just sat through such a long time where it felt such a gendered presentation. But it's a very vivid metaphor, some of you may recognize, but under the circumstances it seemed to me rather tasteless. I'll conclude. I'm really out of time. Enough, as often, you know, that language has often come from the other side of the debate as well. It was the president of EMI Canada who said a few years ago that copyright was a war, and so the user's rights side is taking it up as well. DRM is not a UTI. I mean, you know, it isn't. And so what are ways that we can talk about this? How can we choose our metaphors, you know, at least more variously to encourage more participation and perhaps more accurate discussion? You got a picture of that? I think I'm right on this point. So my conclusion is still just in process, and I look forward to further discussion. And what the relation is between gender and all these other issues is not always clear to me, but I do think that they're related. The first thing that I became aware of as I looked at the Facebook page was the importance of not equating concerned citizens or active scholars with visibility on the internet. And or with identification with polarized opinion. The Facebook site in question is called Fair Copyright for Canada, but it is very much a particular view of users' rights that dominates on that site. And I think that there are a lot of people, and this is not particularly a gender issue, but a lot of people who have concerns about copyright who might not put themselves in such a polarized position. And in the instances where people came onto the site and wanted to speak about creators' rights, they were slammed down pretty aggressively. So what's fairness? And we talked a little bit earlier this morning about ways of adjudicating fairness and perhaps gendered patterns and thinking about what fairness might be. Questioning claims about community. So the Facebook group is a community, but it's a visible community, and there are perhaps other ones that aren't so visible that are also active and also possibly quite powerful in terms of advocacy for the public interest. Multiplying forms of engagement and ranges of examples will be obvious for anyone at this conference, and you can see how I think important it is, not just for our analysis of the law as it will be and as it could be and as it has been, but also in terms of planning advocacy. And finally, I think it will be important to question the user-creator binary more fully. Of course, it's an old saw that users are creators and creators are users and all this kind of thing. But what I see, for example, in a film like the RIP movie or the RIP film, is that the DJ here is put in the place once again of the romantic male author. We really have the same discourse, even though it's a remix discourse, and the extent to which collaborative work is recognized is really quite limited. And on the other hand, this is almost a contrary kind of argument, is that we need to recognize the validity of that distinction in some cases. So recognizing that there is a difference between creators who are trying to earn a living and other forms of creators. Of course, it's a mobile thing, and of course, many people create in ways that will enhance their reputation and later produce income and all these things. But maybe this speaks to some of the questions raised earlier about making money and whether you want to justify something because you don't make money by it. That if you want to include in the whole conversation all the perspectives, it will be important to really be more precise about that language of users and creators than has been done in the past. And I do think there's a gender dynamic to that, if only because there's such a long tradition within the history of thinking about authorship of the procreation metaphor, where procreation being easier for men than it is for women, the model for creativity is seen as quick is good. And there's quite a lot of that in the kind of remix culture, which I think doesn't even do justice to the nature of the creativity there, as also your examples have shown. It's very laborious and skill-based to be able to do all sorts of digital manipulation, but there's this kind of mystique of ease. And I think there is really a gender dimension there that is worth attending to. So thanks, that's all I have.
So, lots of questions raised.
Rebecca?
This is all very fascinating. I just wanted to say one thing about Mary Beth Peters, which is I'm fascinated by the way in which not only is she not saying there's anything wrong with it, but as you presented it, she's sort of an incipient fangirl for Girl Talk, right? Like she's admiring his creative prowess, which is kind of working against the what they say the message is in a way, and they don't even notice that because the position of, you know, worshipful fangirl is sort of is just unnoticeable, even when you're saying that she's the copyright coming for you, which I just find amazing. I also do want to say, in terms of creators trying to earn a living, I understand your point, although I want to be clear. You were talking about creators trying to earn a living with their creativity. That is, everybody in general is trying to earn a living. Unless their parents help, some of us just subsidize certain forms of our creativity by working day jobs.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, no, that's a really good point about Mary Beth Peters too, because she's completely awestruck by what he's doing, and that seems to count against her rather than for her in an odd way.
Could people who are asking questions come to the mic? I know it's
or we have the mic.
I was wondering for Karen if GWC is open to sort of creative forms of academia for the journal?
Yes.
Like thick as paper?
Like what?
Like a thick as a paper? Like is that?
No.
Not like that, but we have received an inquiry, but we haven't seen the final product of somebody who is going to do a sort of games-based critique of games through a game format. And then she would have a paper accompanying it that would explain what she was doing. But I think it was her master's thesis or something, and I never heard back from her. So, but in theory, we're open to some sort of non-traditional expressions. And definitely it's more than media studies. We recently got a paper about material culture, somebody quilting, stuff like that. We're really interested in broadening the idea of transformation. And actually, if I could, well, I have the microphone. Something Laura was saying, I mean, the whole idea of somebody in Canada taking on that United States copyright thing to broaden the audience. A friend of mine edits a journal. She's Canadian, and the person she co-edits the journal with is British. And they were asked to edit a journal, and they ended up choosing a United Kingdom-based publisher because they had more permissive fair use laws. So they specifically cited their journal they created it in a place where they would have the kinds of laws that would permit them to do things like screen caps. So in the journal publishing field, one thing that people who are publishing the journal may look at is, what country can we be out of where we can have what we want? So I just wanted to mention that as a possibility. For those of you who want to start journals, maybe the British model would be better.
Okay. This question is for Jordan. I'm intrigued by this idea of using fan works. In my humanist capacity, I teach rewritings, and I teach in particular a Sudanese novel called Season of Migration to the North, which I've sometimes taught in a postcolonial literature context without reference to Othello, which is what it reworks. But I always love it when I can work it out in the syllabus that I tuck Othello in some other capacity, evidence, reading, rhetoric, and then 6 weeks later when we get to Season, you know, the students discover it in a couple of different capacities. And I love that experience. It seems to me that when you're in a copyright classroom and you want all the students to have kind of equal ability to judge the transformativeness, the Blanche V. Coons cases, the ones where you have appropriation art and you can look at the original or the source work and the fan text or appropriation side by side, everyone's on an equal footing. My understanding about the way fandom works, after talking to Christina yesterday and having this be proven by Evelyn in the green dress, right, the Doctor Who correction, that was awesome, right? But it seems as though the way fan texts work is to proceed based on community knowledge and a really deep knowledge of the structures and the vicissitudes within the source work. So are there fan works that rework very short things rather than 18 seasons of The Simpsons, which seems maybe not administrable as an assignment?
I wasn't able to really get into kind of the structure of how you would put together the curriculum, just because I wanted to do some mock classroom experience. But without offending fans like myself, yes, there are fans. You can read fic without really, or see vid, or listen to folk without actually having deep ingrained knowledge. I've actually found the fic before I found my fandom. I have seen an episode of something that I was interested in, I typed it into the internet, and boom, 6 million fanfic sites popped up, and I went into that. So part of what I'm proposing is a juxtaposition. Go out, go forth, bring me something that you are interested in, whatever it is. Come back, you know, submit it to me, or not me, but as if I were the professor, submit it to the professor and have the professor choose the most palatable to everyone, whether it's because they're a particular fan or not, and then say they're rewriting just a scene like I had up there, or not a scene, but say they're rewriting a missing scene or they're rewriting something, you can actually show the scene and then show the fic, the fic itself, and this is what it's supplementing. Let's discuss that. But yes, there are shorter, condensed, easier, more palatable fandoms or fics and works out there.
So, going back to the film for a minute, I have a question, but I also wanted just to make an additional comment about its peculiarities. One of which is that although you're completely correct in saying that Brett has placed the film in the United States, in a sense, both in terms of the legal surrounding and in terms of many of the actual locales, it is very much a United States of the imagination rather than a United States that you can recognize in copyright terms, because what Brett has imagined is a copyright system without fair use, in which every transgression is an infringement, rather than a system in which uses are sorted, accurately or inaccurately as the case may be, into uses of right and transgressive uses. And the question is whether anyone, because I know the film has had a great deal of circulation, whether anyone other than yourself in this presentation has commented on the extraordinarily biased and misleading nature of the presentation.
I don't know that they have yet. And I agree with you. Fair use is mentioned, but it's essentially dismissed as useless and not really fully explained. So it's a big concern of mine, and also the only kind of political message of the film is remix the film, which is fine, and it's fun, and he's got a website where people, and like I say, it needs feminist remixes, so anyone who wants to go do it, and other kinds as well. So that's interesting as well, but he doesn't place it in any kind of practical context at all, either for the U.S. or Canada.
One thing that has occurred to me in thinking about this is that those of us who do and who work around fair use are well aware of the attitude that is enacted in that film. It's also essentially Larry Lessig's public attitude on fair use as well. Fair use is the right to hire a lawyer. Fair use is a snare and a delusion. Fair use is a will-o'-the-wisp, which it seems to me is an angle that works very well for certain sort of alpha male authority figures and may not work quite so well for the rest of us who have to labor under the real conditions of production and consumption to which fair use is actually an important contributing element. And I hadn't ever thought about that. I want to think about it more, but I offer it for what it's worth.
Well, as you would know very well, the challenge becomes how to create a compelling and concise public message that is not oversimplifying. That, I think, is the challenge for all of us who are working in this area, because this vision is very compelling to certain people, and it's sexy, it's lively, and whatever. So how could we do better and still get press coverage or still get people to pay attention? And well, it's an ongoing challenge.
I wanted to comment more on
could you take the
documentary is really, I really enjoyed it, but particularly because it is Canadian. It's Canadian for more than one reason. It really shows off the dominant Canadian advocacy, which is the view of one person who gets a lot of attention in the media, is aligned very closely with Lessig's ideas, but doesn't necessarily take on Lessig's ideas as a whole. And this sort of lack of fair use in the Canadian context, I mean, fair use, fair dealing, they're different. So the lack of mention of fair use was interesting to me. And overall, I think advocacy as a Canadian practitioner and as a Canadian academic, it's intimidating because you're not just going up against one ideology, you're going up against a brand. It's a brand of one person's ideologies in my mind. And to be louder and to get the attention of the media is very difficult, and it is intimidating. So I know, Laura, I know your blog. Laura is one of the most active females in the area. There are others, but they just don't command the same kind of attention from everybody. So the Facebook group, it was incredible. I mean, it got so much attention, and this was sort of the dominant person's view, and they're able to do that. The scary part is that they're able to do that, and how do we weigh in on that conversation as women, but other academics as well that don't share that dominant view. So as far as Canadians know, the general public thinks, you know, U.S. copyright law is bad, but sitting here studying it, I definitely don't agree. I think there's components of it we should look at, like fair use and what fair use really means. So I appreciate your film for more than one reason, but it's not for those that I've mentioned.
Thanks.
One more question?
So this is a question not for me, but for my partner who's in Toronto at York University watching right there. And so she sent me a question, which I'm gonna ask. So the question is, directed at Laura, but also all of you, what do you think that an online participatory culture technology might look like if it was geared more towards women's participation style and, it says, literally less oppressive?
Less what?
Less oppressive.
Less oppressive. I would be tend to throw that out to others, but one thing I have thought about is when I interviewed one of the IP professors who said that she didn't want to have to report her thoughts the instant she had them. I don't know to the extent to which that is gendered. I'm, you know, cautious to make that claim. But myself,
as you will note if you look at my blog, it has a very slow pace of turnover. Sometimes I blog once a week, sometimes it's less often than that. And so I was thinking, well, gee, there should be a more collective blogging, as you know, as happens in other circles like the feminist law blog, right? Where there's more collaboration, and that might be a way to get more people to have public voices if they didn't feel that pressure to have to do it every 5 minutes. You know, not quite the Twitter model. That I don't think would be just enabling for women, but for all sorts of other people who are feeling like they need another model of discussion. In terms of media presence, I guess maybe to pick up on the previous comment. The media only go to the person who they know will answer the phone and answer the question. But I think maybe more kind of referral and cultivation of the skills of talking to the media by the leading people in the area would be helpful, and then everyone else having to push themselves too. But I don't know, I'll be interested in other people's solution, because it's a problem for me and I think that needs to be solved.
Let me just close with a concept, because some of this discussion from the perspective of feminist theory tends to fall into a kind of essentializing mode. Women are more likely to do X and men are more likely to do Y, which, and then people modify that and say, well, it's not all women and it's not all men. And a concept which I think applies very usefully here, and people have used in other domains like sports, is the notion of hegemonic masculinity. That it invites men in to this discussion by saying that men are harmed. I mean, it takes in the harming or the resistance of men to this kind of masculinity, and enables criticism of women who engage in forms of advocacy that or positions that we might want to criticize but hold ourselves back because, well, that's a woman and I don't want to criticize her. In bringing feminism in, we don't want to oversimplify the depth that cultural criticism has achieved in other ways, and to enable us to think about strategies that then challenge the hegemonic, the dominant, and the ways that gets coded as masculine rather than they're guys, and so there's something appealing about that and something not. So it's a plea for maintaining the complexity that this whole field and the practices in this field bring, the ways that it's cutting edge to the understanding of feminism too. So thank you all.